just a year ago this week, Ronald Reagan was elected as President of the United States. Inflation and a faltering economy were certainly the major factors behind the massive mandate which he received that November day. The real income of most Americans was dropping, however slightly. There was inflation, double-digit inflation, from which we were all suffering. And the society was obviously not able to provide sufficient jobs, particularly for those who were just entering into the workforce. And obviously there were few across the land who really believed that Jimmy Carter had a game plan, the wisdom and the will, in order to turn the economy around. Shortly after he took the oath of office, President Reagan announced what he called a proposal for economic recovery, whose major features, as far as they affected the average citizen, were budget cuts and tax cuts. And all of the background, the theory behind this proposal for economic recovery was something which was called supply-side economics, whose major thesis was that by increasing the available sums for investment, for new ventures, for the retooling of industry, American industry would again become competitive in the world markets and could produce the goods and services required by the nation, and as it expanded, would be able to produce the jobs which the workforce required. Stagflation, that coined word which meant a flat economy, falling somewhat behind the rate of development of the world with double-digit inflation, was to be cured by a remedy which sought to increase the pool of available capital. And if you recall the early months of the spring, during the first month of Mr. Reagan's administration, the magazines and the papers were filled with the thesis that the 1980s would be the time for the reindustrialization of America. New plants, more efficient equipment, new means of communication, new computers, new electronic devices, more research and development, all aimed at making our economy prosperous, expansive, and so as to be able to do the job that an economy must do in a society. In order to achieve this pool of capital, there would be tax cuts, basically for the corporate society, for industry, more rapid depreciation allowances, basically for the wealthy of the land, on the assumption that the poor of the land would spend the dollars they might receive for necessities. They wouldn't go into, those monies would not be available for investment. And so the results, the consequence of supply-side theory and of what came to be called Reaganomics, was essentially a tax cut, or a proposal for tax cuts, which would increase the wealth of the wealthy, the wealth, the profit, and the power of industry, and decrease the ability of the poor in the measure as programs, social programs on which they depended, were cut, in measure as their proportion of the tax burden was increased relative to the society as a whole. And given the fact that at the same time the president proposed massive increases in defense spending, the budget cuts which were proposed were massive indeed in the long term, at least, insofar as they affected all those programs which have to do with the support of the other America, the 10 or 15 or 20% of Americans who do not fully enjoy the opportunity or the prosperity of our land. Now, such was the size of the president's victory. Brought along, you'll recall, a Republican Senate, and he increased markedly the Republican minority in the House, that by July of this year, he had on his desk a proposal from the Congress which agreed to $35.2 billion in budget cuts from the budget which had been proposed for this October 1 year by the Carter administration. And by the first week in August, his rhetoric had become the rule of the land insofar as tax cuts were concerned. A proposal was on his desk for signature, a bill was on his desk for signature, which spoke of a staggered 3-year, 25% tax cut on personal incomes, a major proportion of which was to be allowed, be allocated to the upper levels of those of wealth, and major increases in terms of the benefits that corporations would receive. Their proportion of the tax burden in the United States would continue to decrease. And perhaps the most interesting long-range and most important long-range part of this measure was the statement that the last budget that the Reagan administration would propose during the fourth year of its mandate would set the level of taxes for succeeding years, for after that all taxes would be indexed, and the government would only have to spend that proportion of the gross national product, the proportion of the total wealth of the country, which it had spent in the last year of the first Reagan administration, and so it's, in a sense, its funds, its ability to serve the nation, to provide services, provide new programs, would be frozen at a given level. Now, everyone is in favor of tax cuts. And I think that most people in the country were prepared to admit that over the years, there had developed such pork barreling and feather nesting by bureaucrats and boondoggling of the one kind or another. There was a great deal of fat in the federal budget, and the federal budget does not represent the sum total of federal expenditures, but in the expenditures of the federal government, and that it was time to take a good, hard look at what was being done, what was being spent, that in fact too much was being spent. Perhaps some of it was being spent unwisely. And this country as a whole, I think, was in agreement, if not with the specifics of the 35.2 first budget cut that is now in effect, but certainly with the thesis that they thought was behind it, that we would trim the fat and remain with the lean, that the government would become more efficient and more effective, and everyone was in favor of what was called a belt-tightening austerity budget. And so when the president proposed in that first budget cut that a number of services for which the society as a whole were paying would be paid now in terms of user fees, fees for the use of airports by private planes, the use of waterways of the Coast Guard, by yachts and by bargemen, some total of $2 billion, other things of this kind, as a whole, the society approved of these changes. And they certainly approved of the attempt to force those who manage the various programs which are now in place to look at their programs and to make sure that we're receiving a dollar's worth of service for every dollar of expenditure. But I think it's important to recognize that a budget is not so much simply a list of the things that the government will do, but by and large it is a statement of the political philosophy of a country, a statement of how the goods, the services, the benefits, and the wealth of the, and the power of the country will be benefited, will be distributed. And that though, I am not an economist, obviously, and not, certainly not an economic theoretician, I do think that if we recognize that the numbers that economists use, and they love to use numbers, numbers pour out of their computers, and they look so scientific, so factual, so accurate. In point of fact, a number is an artificial symbol. And most of the numbers which are used in developing one economic theory or another and developing the budget are simply convenient ways in which we try to compress historic and political facts. That is, the vagaries of human society, so as to get some grip on them, some hold on them, to be able to fashion them, to shape them, to understand them. Though we teach economics in the university in the area of social sciences, and though economists would love to be able to think of themselves as scientists who can accurately predict, accurately describe the ways in which society operates and how it should operate. In point of fact, the social sciences, all of them, history, sociology, economics, are really art forms more than pure sciences. They deal in approximations, not in certainties. And the numbers with which the economists deal, whether it be microeconomists or macroeconomists or any other kind of economist, are really simply numbers which belie the uncertainty, the vagaries, the shapelessness of much that is beneath. A budget is not so much figures as the result of a long history, a series of political decisions and political events. And the president, or in any administration, has only a very limited ability to change these figures unless he, as this president has done, aims at a major policy change which would affect the distribution of wealth and of power in the United States in a radical form. And it's that proposition that I'd like to place before you this morning. But what we have before us is not so much simply a shrinking of the federal budget, a reduction of the role of government, to which I think many would agree. But we have a policy, whether it will not be fully effected depends upon Congress as well as administration. What we have in place is an administration committed to a policy which is the very reverse of the policy of the New Deal and of the Fair Deal, which also aimed at the redistribution of power and of wealth and of status and of the benefits of the society, but in favor of the lesser classes of the society, the people who had less, the other American. That policy over a number of decades led to that great opening up of American opportunity, the classless society towards which we thought we were aiming. This budget proposal, in a sense, reverses that policy. And what we have in place now, or certainly being enunciated now, is an approach to the budget based on an economic theory which, like all economic theories, Marxian, Keynesian, supply side, are simply really ideologies, convenient ways to justify a redistribution of the wealth according to certain preconceived political, social, and ideological considerations. But if Mr. Reagan and his minions have their way, over a period of time, the wealthy will get richer, the poor will get poorer, the social services will be fewer, the power of the corporate world will be larger, and some very basic systemic changes will have occurred in our society. Now, one can criticize supply-side economics in many ways. One can wonder, for instance, whether or not, given this new pool of corporate profit which is to be in place, this new pool of private wealth which is to be in place, people will, in fact, invest it in research, development, retooling, these positive ways. The immediate experience of the past few years suggests that corporations which have had the greatest wealth have, to a very large degree, sought simply to take over other productive companies rather than to go out and to create new oil wells, to find new machinery, to create new means of production. One thinks of the Conoco, one thinks of the headlines of yesterday and the day before of Marathon Oil and Mobil. There is no reason to believe that greed being what it is, the leaders of American business will operate the way supply-side theory assumes that they will. And there is a further point, of course, that a percentage of the American industrial establishments is not owned by Americans. We now have the multinational corporation. We now have major investments, particularly by energy-rich countries and individuals in the American economy. And there is obviously no guarantee that the money that they get from these new profits, this reduction of taxation, will be reinvested in the American economy. Maybe reinvested in the economies of their own country or in some entirely different way. And one could go on with these kinds of criticisms. But the point, I think, is that supply-side economics, Reaganomics, is based on a theory of the redistribution of wealth and of power, which many of us would, for quite moral reasons, quite apart from economic reasons, find unacceptable. And moreover, it is an attempt to hold before the American people a dream, a nostalgic dream, which is no longer realizable. It's a program for economic recovery. It's a program which claims to promise to the American people the prosperity, that rich prosperity which we enjoyed in the 1950s and early 1960s. The 1950s, 1960s, the end of the Second World War, the American dollar was the only currency that counted. The American industrial base was the only real productive industrial society in the world. The rest of the world was still rebuilding after the war, still paying the costs of the war. We didn't have much competition in the world. We enjoyed a great deal of the wealth and the privilege of the world. And those days, my friends, are gone forever. Mr. Reagan, supply-side economics, or any other economics, notwithstanding. We've had the rise of countries with the will, the wit, to compete effectively with us. We're no longer the great industrial nation whose products dominate the market. Japan and Germany have found ways of producing cars and computers and high technology equipment equal to and in some ways superior and often cheaper than we do. Southeast Asian countries, South Korea, Taiwan, other countries like that have been able to compete with us for major building contracts across the world, which we once took for granted as belonging to us. Shoes, textiles, leathers, goods, all these kinds of goods can be produced more cheaply and more efficiently by other countries than by us. And where we once dominated the armaments market, that very profitable market which led to the AWACS sale and to other things of this kind over the last decade, the Soviet Union, Czechoslovakia, West Germany, France, England are now active and efficient competitors with us for those markets. We're not alone in the world any longer. We can't expect the kind of prosperity we enjoyed 25 years ago to return. As the world comes up to our level, which was based to a certain degree on privilege, must decrease. And any president or any administration or any ideologue who promises us otherwise misleads us. And then, of course, after 1973, there was the oil shock. Oil, which had cost us $6 a barrel in 1972, will cost us $34 a barrel in 1982. And I hope you all noticed how grateful the Saudis were for the AWACS sale. The very next day, they thanked President Reagan by increasing their base cost by $2 a barrel, and more importantly, by decreasing their oil output by 1 million barrels a day, thus guaranteeing further oil cost rises in the next year or so. Whatever the strength or weakness of Reaganomics may be, I think it's clear that if the president continues to be able to have his way, and there's no guarantee that he will, there's obviously great pressure in many places in the land to rescind the second and third year tax cuts, and Reagan is himself and his administration is talking about other kinds of taxed income. There is some resistance now to the second $16 billion tax cut proposal, which the administration has sent down to Congress, but Congress so far has refused really to receive. Certainly if David Stockman and his office will propose multi-billion dollar cuts in January of this year, of next year as they propose, there will be opposition to that. But if we continue in this vein, I think we must be prepared for two very basic and very simple truths. The first is that the quality of life, particularly urban life in America, will diminish. Our roads will become more bumpy, less cared for. Our bridges will continue to fall down and to fall apart. Our public school system will begin to fall away from us. Why spend public monies when one can finance private education in a variety of ways? The level of medical care available to most Americans will quickly go beyond the ability of most Americans to pay for it, and so simply we will have less medical care than we have now. The infrastructure, to use that terrible word which economists love, the infrastructure of American life, mass transit, our water systems, our sewage systems, our ports, our airfields, all the things which we take for granted, all these will become shabbier, less well cared for, and less available to us. And the second, and perhaps more dangerous in the long term, is that the division between the haves and the have-nots will increase. It will be more and more difficult for the have-nots to cross into the land of opportunity, even though they live in the land of opportunity. And it will be more and more difficult for them to even believe that they have any opportunity to do so. Once one is consigned to the poverty level, there will be less and less of a leverage, less and less programs in place, less and less opportunity, and therefore more and more anger, more and more bitterness, more and more street violence, a basic attack ultimately on the structure of our society. Now, I don't know if 21.5% of the gross national product, in terms of being soaked up by the government and spent again in various expenditures, is too great a figure or too little a figure. This is a figure which is in place now. I suggest that it depends upon the programs. I suggest it depends upon the consequences of each program as it works itself out in the society. I can't imagine in a complex, highly industrialized society such as ours, one can ever contemplate going much below a 20% figure. We need services from the government, services of all kinds, and you will become quite aware of that as these services are one by one stripped away from you. It is not more efficient to do things on a local level than on a national level. You can see that simply in local terms. We've been fighting in Cuyahoga County for years for county government or metropolitan government. Why? Because it's less efficient to have the police, to have the fire, to have all the safety forces, to have sewage, to have the zoo, to have the cultural activities on the narrowest level, reduced to 32 governing units in one county, and much more efficient to do it on a county level or on a metropolitan level. And that's true across the board. It seems to me that Mr. Reagan has done many of us a disservice in this sense also, that he has focused our thought on economic problems which are not the real economic problems. This country has serious economic problems. But these economic problems are not, as Mr. Reagan and his minions would have us believe, solely the responsibility of big government, that we pay too many taxes and get too little back in return. We may be paying too many taxes, we may get too little back in return, but that's not the major problem. The major problem is that our industry is archaic and often misguided. I give you Lockheed, I give you the railroads, I give you all those other bailouts which we've had to go into. That labor is not productive and has been more interested in fringe benefits than in producing the goods of the society. That the great basic industries on which this city depends so much, steel, iron, ore, and the like, have been traditionally industries which, at least until the late 70s, did not invest any of their profit in any real substantive sense in research and development, in retooling. When the years of profit, they took their profits, and now they're asking the government to subvent what should have been done 20 years ago, if they truly were part of a free enterprise system and understood its basic terms. Industry is at fault, labor is at fault, our love of luxuries is partially at fault. And good government may to a certain degree be at fault, but it's not alone. And simply by shrinking the size of government, you'll not wave a magic wand and make American prosperity return to the land. And secondly, Mr. Reagan has focused our attention on the size of the national budget, as if somehow by balancing the budget, we will miraculously become prosperous again. And we've had that famous image of the $1 trillion budget deficit as a stack of $1,000 bills 67 miles high. And since you and I cannot imagine what $1 trillion means, it seems overwhelming. We agree with him almost instinctively, yet yes, we must balance the budget at all costs immediately last year, if not before. But it's interesting when you read the economists and those who deal with this matter. They remind us that during the heyday of our prosperity at the end of the Second World War in the 50s and 60s, the federal deficit in proportion to national wealth, to the gross national product, was 2 to 3 times what it is today. Around 1950, the deficit in terms of the gross national product was 135% of that gross national product. Today it's less than 35%. And the percentage of our debt in relationship to the total goods and services produced in the land has been decreasing over time. It's been increasing in real numbers, but society, the economy has been increasing at a greater rate. And most economists, if one can believe what they say, and I think we can in this case because most of them are academicians, not representatives of industry, most of them say that the level of deficit which we now maintain is not the real problem facing the society. And yes, we ought not to be paying double-digit monies for the monies the government has to borrow, but that's really not the major problem. We had prosperity when we were much more indebted than we are today. The problem has to do with machinery, it has to do with manpower, it has to do with skill, it has to do with competitive will, with other kinds of problems than the debt itself. Now, Mr. Reagan has used the specter of the trillion-dollar debt in order to frighten all of us to the importance of shrinking government. But his proposals to shrink government must be looked at, because they are not equal. It is not an austerity budget. It is a redistribution of power, redistribution of wealth, redistribution of benefits budget. Ultimately, in the give and take of politics, farm subsidies remain. The windfall profits for energy companies remain. Faster write-offs for business remain. The tax levels for the wealthy go down. The wealth is allowed to pass on larger and larger amounts of its wealth to the next generation. All kinds of protections given to American business because of foreign competition remain in place. This is not an austerity budget. It's austerity for the poor. It will ultimately be austerity for the middle class. But it's not austerity for the corporate society. It's not austerity for the people who surround Mr. Reagan. So far, we're 1 month in to the first round of budget cuts. And we've not yet begun to feel how the shoe will pinch, because most of us are not affected by most of the cuts which are in place. These cuts affect the poor, will affect the poor more than they will affect the middle class, because in the political bargaining which went into that bill, Mr. Reagan agreed ultimately not to touch most of the income redistribution proposals which affect the middle class. Social Security, Medicare, veterans benefits, basic unemployment insurance. These remained, at least for now, in place. What he did instead was to cut some 15% from the food stamp program. And in this instance, I must tell you a conversation I had this summer. It was the country club. And when we were talking about the federal budget, and the man whom I was talking with, I was delighted with the cut in the food stamp program. The food stamp program has all kinds of cheats in it, he told me, people driving up to the supermarkets in new cars and loading up with all kinds of wines and luxury items rather than staples. And the conversation went on for 10 minutes, 15 minutes, 20 minutes in this kind of way, and it was interesting because within a half hour he was telling me with some glee how he'd had his children apply to the government for scholarship aid, low-interest scholarship loans, because he could reinvest that money at a higher rate of interest. Money will be cut from the food stamp program. Money will be cut from federal lunch program. Monies are cut from Medicaid. Much of the cuts will not be seen until the states begin to apply the new federal regulations, because they're involved in block grants. Cuts have taken place in those areas up till now which to a certain degree allowed the poor to defend themselves. The entire program of free legal aid to the poor was chopped in this first round. $300 million, not a great deal of money. But what it really means is that the poor no longer have an advocate because they can't afford to challenge bureaucracy, to challenge the slum landlord. He can beat them by paying for the lawyers, and they have hardly the money to do so. Consumer defense, all these kinds of programs have gone or will go soon by the board. And what we find ourselves then into is a situation in which the margin of safety for the poor between poverty, which perhaps is survivable given social welfare benefits, and death diminishes. Mr. Reagan has talked about a safety net which he will put or see that it will remain so that no one falls to his death during these programs. But I'm afraid the safety net is going to have a lot of holes in it. Not the kind of holes which are tax loopholes, but holes which will find a family somehow not conforming to some very rigid standard which somebody has set up and therefore being denied the very benefit on which life depends. We saw the other day, most of us, that one of the ways to save some money was to declare ketchup to be a vegetable, and therefore one didn't have to serve a vegetable at lunch in the free lunch program. That kind of logic, which is the bureaucratic way of dealing with cuts demanded by the federal budget, is a way which will ultimately lead, what, to malnutrition, back to junk foods, the very things which we've been trying to avoid in a healthier and more open America. And I'm firmly convinced that though the middle class feels secure for the moment, in order to achieve the ends, the real ends of this administration, ultimately, Social Security benefits will be held in place or shrunk. Ultimately, various kinds of pension benefits will be held or shrunk relative to the cost of living. And that the very programs which have given the middle class their ease, their security, will be attacked. Now, obviously, there's a political reality behind all of this. Congress must vote for what the administration proposes. But where the administration would like to go is clear. What they would like to achieve, I think, is a return to that America of the 1920s, when there were very few legal protections for the poor, where the Constitution was being interpreted to protect the corporations and the wealth of the rich, and where little consideration was being given, all in the name of a theory called free enterprise, capitalism, little attention was being given to the legitimate, inalienable rights of every individual to security, to a job, to opportunity, to health care. Now, obviously, there have to be realistic, prudential limits to all of this. But that's not the direction of this administration. This administration is ideologically motivated and is seeking to put America on the path towards a redistribution of power, wealth, and benefit, which is the reverse of the direction we've been on for the last 40 years or so. And I, for one, consider this to be a tragic direction. I believe that the economy must be made more competitive. I believe that industry must retool. I believe that we must become more efficient, that we need greater productivity. But I believe that all this must be achieved insofar as it can be achieved within the context of an American dream, which is my dream and not Mr. Reagan's. Which is a dream of the founding fathers and not of Mr. Reagan. A dream which looks to the common weal and the larger good, and looks not to simply to numbers on balance sheets, but to human beings and human resources. I think all of us have to look at ourselves and ask ourselves, what have we taken? What have we given in return? Have we been productive members of our society? Do we really understand the context in which we will live for the next 20 or 30 years? Are we prepared for the belt tightening that it will require? I'm not arguing that there oughtn't to be tax, that we oughtn't to pay higher taxes, or that a government should not be cut. I'm simply arguing that the means in which we should use should be based on an economic theory and an ideology, which includes the human dimension, as well as purely the corporate dimension, the dimension of corporate benefit, the dimension which I think is the sole criteria behind supply-side economics, behind Reaganomics. I'm not one, I don't want to stand here and suggest to you that Mr. Reagan will have his way. Although after the AWACS sale, I'm not so sure he won't have his way. But I want you to recognize, insofar as this rabbi is concerned, that I'm not impressed with an economic ideology which is so indifferent to the human equation. I'm prepared as an individual, I think we all ought to be prepared, to pay more, to have less, in order that the society can remain an open society. I'm not prepared to support an administration which bases its vision of American prosperity on belt tightening for those who have the least and on greater greed for those who have the most. Amen.